In this episode, I am honored to speak with Henry Ma. Henry has been an income dividend investor for more than 30 years. He retired in 2008 at the age of 66. At the highest point, his dividend income was three times higher than his expenses. In this wide-ranging interview, we're going to cover why Henry does not focus on capital appreciation, why ETFs didn't provide him with the income that he could get from owning individual stocks, why some people are afraid to invest, and the biggest fear people have about investing. We also talk about rising interest rates and high inflation, and most important of all, dividend investing. Hi, my name is Kanwal Sarai, and welcome to the Simply Investing Dividend Podcast. Henry Ma was born in 1942 and just turned 81 this year. He served in the Royal Canadian Air Force, worked with A&W, opened a manufacturing company, and worked as an accounting and computer consultant until his retirement in 2008. Henry only got interested in investing in stocks when he turned 50. His passion for income investing continues today, and he has published four books on investing and runs his investing blog at risingyieldoninvestments.blogspot.com. Henry, welcome to the Simply Investing Dividend Podcast.
Thank you, Kanwal. I really appreciate being on your show.
Thanks for being here. Henry, when did you get started with dividend investing?
Wow. I think we have to go back about 25 years. Certainly not any longer. I didn't start investing until I was 50. So that means I started about 30 years ago. But the first five, maybe 6 years, I went through the normal mistakes. We didn't really understand much about investing, and we just started buying and selling stocks, hoping that we could generate some capital gains. Eventually, we got connected with a financial advisor, and he directed us to mutual funds, GICs, and over the next maybe 3 years, I think our GICs outperformed the mutual funds. And that's when we decided to really start maybe taking back control of our investments. And it just happened by sheer accident. I came across an article by Tom Connolly from his Connolly Report. And the first line of that article said, if you have a financial advisor, get rid of him or her. Of course, that tied into exactly what I was thinking about. And later in the article, not that far down, there was a statement that really struck home with me. It basically said that if a company doesn't pay a dividend, don't buy it. If it doesn't grow the dividend, don't buy it either. And I didn't immediately understand what he was talking about because we'd owned dividend stocks and we saw those checks coming in, but they didn't mean much to us. So I started researching dividend growth and I tried to get onto the Connolly subscription list, but he wasn't accepting any more subscribers. I couldn't believe it. Who wouldn't accept new money? Anyways, it took me maybe another year before I really started buying dividend stocks. And even then we made mistakes. I didn't fully grasp the concept. We bought some higher yielding stocks. We bought a REIT. We bought an income trust because they offered what I thought was some security. At least it sounded like it. So it took us maybe another 2 years before we understood that all those products with higher yields really are not good performers. So we eventually sold them all and began concentrating more on what we considered the better dividend-paying stocks.
Thanks, Henry. That's a great story. I also know Tom Connolly, and I had the same experience. I tried to get on his investing newsletter, and just like you, He said he wasn't taking on any new subscribers.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it took me, I think, almost a year to convince him to take me on as a subscriber. And I continually sent him emails. And finally, I think he did it just to get me to stop sending him emails. But Tom and I have become, of course, I consider him a mentor, but I also consider him a good friend.
I also consider Tom a mentor. We did email back and forth over the years, and I was so happy when he finally let me subscribe to his newsletter. So, Henry, was it the income generation that attracted you to dividend investing?
Not so much the income. I was looking for an alternative to capital appreciation. We had gone through the buying and selling, and we went through looking at the market and trying to really get a handle on how to achieve capital gains. And there just didn't seem to be a logical way to do it. You know, every time we thought we had a winner, something happened, and of course, we lost money on it, or we ended up selling at a break-even point. And it took a while before, I think after we were investing in dividend growth stocks for a year and a half, 2 years, we started to recognize the income growth. And that encouraged us to kind of invest more into dividend growth stocks. But we were still of the mindset of capital gains. I mean, even today, most investors, or of course, probably all investors, consider total return to be capital gains and plus dividends, the little portion of dividends. And I began to realize that dividends really can generate a lot of income. And it took me a while to recognize that I don't even need to concentrate on capital gains. If I really focus in on dividends and make sure that I do everything I can to increase my income with the investments I hold, then I could slowly just ignore capital gains. And I'm talking about things like ETFs, because by the time I got fully into dividend growth stocks, ETFs were, becoming more and more popular across various sectors and markets. And the best way to do that was, to own some ETFs. Well, I did take the time to look at ETFs, but I found that they didn't provide the income that I could generate from owning individual stocks. And so that's how we gradually got into totally concentrating on income rather than growth.
What you've just said is so important. Investors like us focus on the dividend income rather than stock prices, which go up and down all the time. Now, when it comes to owning individual stocks, what is your typical holding period?
Well, initially, we always intended to keep the stocks that we owned, but we also tried to buy into sectors that were doing well, or people were saying that they're doing well. Like, a year ago, people were saying you got to get into energy stocks because oil prices are going up. So get into energy stocks now because the stocks are priced low. Well, from my own experience, I didn't want to get into any cyclical stocks. And energy, of course, falls into that category. So, again, it took a while, but eventually I realized that I only wanted to own stocks that I could own forever. And, certainly a good company can run into trouble. The dividend might be cut. But I found that if I concentrated on what I considered the very best, the chances of dividend cuts were so small that I could almost ignore it. So really, I own a portfolio of 12 stocks. And that's, I'm 81 years old. And, you know, people might say, well, geez, you're 81. Shouldn't you have some fixed assets in there just in case of a market crash? Well, I'm way past that point. I know that markets don't affect my income at all. And I don't expect that even if we have, there's always a situation we might end up with another Great Depression, but the likelihood of that is pretty small. But under normal circumstances, a crash like even the financial crisis really didn't affect my income. You know, it slowed it down, but my income increased over the previous year from 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. It grew every year. And of course, even though the financial crisis didn't get back to the 2008 high for, 4.5 years at least, my income continued to grow. So, you know, I've gotten to the point where I feel good about the stocks I own, and I intend to hold them unless something really desperate happens.
Henry, I mentioned your age at the beginning, and your Twitter profile also says that you are 81 years young. I've been a dividend investor for over 23 years, and you've been an investor for even longer. What advice would you give to someone who's in their 20s and 30s, now has their first day job? How and where should they be investing today?
Well, I think that my preference is that someone should get them investing from the day they're born, not start at 18 or 20 or when they get their first job. And, you know, when kids are born, they get gifts, they have grandparents who are, you know, willing to help out. So I really believe that the younger you start, the better. Now, of course, if you want to start at 20, that's fine. The first thing, of course, they should pay off their debt, or at least try to minimize their debt or have it manageable. If they can manage their debt, then they should start putting some money aside, whether it's $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month. It really depends on how much they can afford. If they can't afford $100 a month, then I would suggest nobody should go into investing without taking the time to learn something about it. When I started at 50, I didn't know a thing about it, and I didn't take the time to learn about it. It took me trial and error, and I made lots of mistakes before I eventually found something that was right for me. So I think that the first thing they should do is get out of debt and then take the time to look at the investment options that are available and come to a decision as to how they want to invest, whether it's ETFs, whether it's, you know, buying riskier stocks. But hopefully if they're a little smarter and they've got some good parents, maybe they'll consider income investing.
Absolutely. I think that if you're going to start off with index funds or ETFs and you're starting with small amounts, that might be okay. But as your investments start to grow and you start to invest more money, your fees are going to add up. Now, for example, I looked this up the other day, $500,000 invested in an ETF where the MER is 0.05%. So that doesn't seem very high. But $500,000 in that ETF over 30 years is going to cost you approximately $80,000 in fees.
The other problem I have with exchange or ETFs is that people say that let's start out with ETFs until you learn something about investing. Well, you're not going to learn anything by investing in ETFs. All you're going to learn is that the value of the ETF is going to increase and decrease with the market. Beyond that, I'm not sure what you're going to learn. Whereas if you learn to invest in individual growth stocks, as you say, every quarter, every year, you'll see that your income is higher than it was before. And that should encourage you to say, hey, I'm earning more money, whether I add money to my investments or whether I just add a few dollars. My income is growing continuously. Or if the market drops, my income continues to grow. And I think that's much more meaningful.
That's a very good point. Like you said, with ETFs or even index funds and mutual funds, you really don't learn how to invest by yourself. You're just handing over your money to someone else to invest on your behalf, and then it's pretty much hands off. So are there certain characteristics that an individual needs to have in order to be successful in the type of investing that you're doing?
Absolutely not. In fact, you know, if I've learned nothing over the time that I've been investing, and especially since I've been investing in dividend growth stock, is that it is by far the simplest and safest method of investing. It almost guarantees success, if, you know, provided you stay with the basic concept of it. If you start investing in riskier stocks or saying, well, I'm only 30, so I can afford to buy Bitcoin, or I can afford to, you know, buy a high-rising stock just for growth, then you're opening yourself up to speculation. But if you stay with the basic concept of dividend growth investing, then you really, almost anybody can learn it. And I know that because I receive emails from all types of people, from people that are just starting out, from people who've been investing for years, you know, women, men, it doesn't matter. And they all say that I didn't realize it was that easy or could be that easy.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. I tell people that this type of investing is so simple, a 9-year-old could do it. And I had both my kids start dividend investing when they were 9. And now they've been investing for many, many years. What advice would you give to someone who says, I'm scared to invest, inflation is too high right now, we might be headed into a recession, and investing in stocks just seems very risky? What advice would you give to someone like that today?
I you know, I'm going to plug my book. I wrote the book specifically to explain how to invest for income and why. But more importantly, I really show them how to do it. I walk them through the step. I tell them where to find the data, how to do the analysis. But it's really up to them, after they've evaluated the stocks, to decide which ones to buy. The one thing I never do is recommend stocks or particular stocks. I really want people to learn to do it themselves. And like you say, it is a simple process. So, in fact, the hardest part for most investors is getting over the fear of the market. 90% of investors, they have a fear of a market crash. What do I do if the market crashes? Or, you know, how do I protect my investment? Well, if they invest for income, then they can totally ignore that segment of investing. And it takes a while. You know, most people have to go through a few downturns. But once they do, and if they recognize that their income is continually growing, then suddenly they say, well, gee, I guess I don't have to worry about the market.
Yes, that's really important. I think it's just human nature. When someone buys a stock for $30 and the price drops to $10, the automatic reaction is to panic.
Yeah. I think that, you know, and what I try to stress through my process, and I think I have a different approach than most people, is that you do all the analysis up front. In other words, when you're first getting into income investing, the idea is to sit down and look at the stocks, evaluate them, do your whatever, due diligence, and then you come up with a list of stocks to consider. That's what I call it, a list of stocks to consider. And my advice is that, well, let me just go through the book. I use the TSX 60 as their recommendation, and it has 60 large companies that make up the TSX. Well, if you follow the process, the evaluation process I recommend, you'll probably eliminate 40 of them, maybe 35 to 40. So that leaves you about 20 to 25 remaining stocks to consider. But that's just the first step. And there may be other companies that you want to look at. But then what I want you to do is take that 25 or 30 stocks that are left and ask yourself and continue to do your assessment and come up with the ones you think that are the best, the very best. And I even have a rating system that I recommend they use. But the idea is to narrow it down to 10, 15, 20. And those are the stocks that they should concentrate on. Because if they do that, they should really believe that, hey, I think I could own any one of those stocks and put $100,000, $200,000 into any one of them and not fear that I'm going to lose my money. Or I'm going to know that I'm going to generate some good income from them. So do your analysis up front. Come up with your list of stocks. Once you have that list, you ignore every other stock that comes up, whether it's recommended by your favorite podcast or blogger. The idea is to totally stick with your own list. You don't have to worry about finding a new stock or reevaluating your stocks. You've done the evaluation. And from that point, you just buy those stocks when they're reasonably priced. So you have 20 or 30 stocks that are on your list. You're not going to buy all of them. You're just going to buy the ones that are currently offering a reasonable yield to you. In fact, I think you had a good segment on that.
Yes, absolutely. I recently did a podcast episode showing exactly how to figure out when a stock is undervalued, priced low, or overvalued, priced high. Henry, we are going to mention your four books in this episode. But right now, which book are you talking about that's going to give people the guidance to pick individual stocks?
Well, definitely the first one, Your Ever-Growing Income, because that's the first book I wrote. And it really explains income investing, explains the process, and then it walks you through the other aspects of investing. And, of course, I think it concentrates on why you should stick with just the stocks on your list. The second book, Your TFSA Compounder, was really, it duplicated the process, but the idea was that you should invest in your TFSA first before any other investment. The intention is get your money into the tax-free savings account and invest it following the income growth strategy. The combination of the two will give you the compounding you need so that 15, 20, 30 years down the road, you'll end up with a bundle of tax-free money and you will know that you'll have enough to live on without having to sell capital.
That's incredible. And in your third book, Income Investing Explained?
Yeah, that one was written because of all the questions I was getting. It just seemed like I didn't quite go into enough detail in my first book about when to buy, how to buy, about dividend cuts, what you should do in case somebody cuts their dividends. So it was really, I took the questions and wrote a book about answering the questions through a book.
That's great. Fantastic. And then your most recent book, and I love the title, Salary for Life.
Yeah, I owe that one to my daughter again. She's a little smarter than I am when it comes to titles. But it started out as a retirement book. You know, there are a lot of books written about a retirement or the things you should consider when retirement or when you're in retirement. But as I started to write it, I sort of said, well, why am I concentrating at the tail end? Because nobody concentrates at the beginning. And that's where I began to say that you really should start out investing the day you're born. Now, of course, the child's not going to do it, but the parents, the grandparents, the relatives. And I have an example. In fact, I have that example in my first book where my wife started an investment account for our grandkids. One was 3 years old, the other was five. So it wasn't quite at birth. But she kicked in $5,000 And over the next 14 years, there was only another $5,000 added to that account. So a total of $10,000 investment. But at the end of 14 years, that account is generating almost $2,000 a year of dividend income.
Wow.
Now, the grandson has turned 18, so he's no longer going to add money to that account, but he's going to leave it alone. He's just going to let the investment sit, let reinvest the dividends. And I got to add one other thing. Over that 14 years, money was not added for 7 of the 14 years. And the company didn't increase the dividend for 4 of those years. So it's not like this particular stock was one that was a great dividend growth company. It was just an average dividend growth stock. So he is no longer investing in that account, but I projected for the next, if he just leaves it till he's age 60 or 65, that stock should generate between $60,000 and $110,000 a year of dividend income. Now, people might say, well, yeah, how can you project that far away? Well, I can't. But what I can do is say that, now I base that projection on his income growing between 9 and 10% a year. Now, for the year, 7 years that no money was added to his account, he's averaging over 10% income growth every year.
Better than any term deposit, GIC, or bond.
Exactly. And all he has to do is every quarter look at his income, the dividend that comes in, and ask himself, is it higher than the previous quarter? At the end of the year, it's a simple calculation to say, is my income higher than 10% or is it 10% or more? If it is, he's on track. So every year his income grows by 10%, he knows that he's getting closer and closer to that $60,000 to $100,000 of dividend income by the time he's 65. Now, even if someone says, yeah, but the money is not going to be worth $100,000 at that age, cut it in half, right? If, let's say, it's only worth $30,000 to $50,000 in today's money, that's not bad for a $10,000 investment where you did nothing else for the rest of your working life.
Absolutely. That's amazing. That's a substantial amount of future income. I'd like to share a quick story with you and our audience highlighting the power of dividends. I went back in time and looked at Walmart stock. If you had bought 100 shares back in 1973 for a total investment of $1,650 and then just held on to the shares, you didn't buy or sell any more shares, just held on to the original 100 shares that you bought in 1973. Today, that investment would be giving you over $500,000 Canadian annually in dividend income.
Yeah, no, the compounding of income is unbelievable. And most people don't recognize that. They're still focused on capital growth. They really believe that you've got to invest for capital growth and that will be the bigger portion of your income. But it really doesn't have to be. There is an alternative.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Now, Henry, without repeating everything in your first book, by the way, I recommend everyone check out that book, can you share with us just one or two things you look for in a company before you buy a stock? Are you looking at the PE ratio, the price to book ratio?
Nope.
The payout ratio or anything like that?
My investing philosophy is like your title. Simple. If it's not simple, then really it's too complicated. And when I was writing, in fact, I developed this process before I wrote the book, but I really came up with what I call the four rules, four steps of evaluating a stock. And they're so simple that, you know, that they're really not that complicated. And they don't, probably most people would say, yeah, but that's not really what you should be doing. You should be looking at PE ratios and price to book and all that stuff. But I think the four rules, if someone follows them, I think they'll find that they will narrow down some pretty good stocks, and they'll eliminate most of the stocks that are not considered dividend growth stocks. And I don't mind mentioning what they are, because the first rule is if a company cuts their dividends within the past 10 years, eliminate them. Don't even consider them. So, second rule, the company must have paid a dividend for a minimum of 10 years. And that's really a minimum. I like companies that pay dividends for 25, 50 years, 100 years. But a 10-year is a reasonable minimum. The third rule is that the company must have grown their dividend at least 8 of the past 10 years. Of course, I prefer continuous growth, but I don't eliminate a company necessarily just because they haven't raised the dividend for a particular reason. And finally, I like to see a dividend growth rate over the past 10 years of at least 75%. And that's just a guideline. You know, there are companies that that I like that have not produced a 75% growth rate over a 10-year period. There are companies that are generating 150% dividend growth rate. But you have to look at that 75% as really a starting point. And then you, if you like a company, whether it's below or above, you want to do a little more analysis or look a little closer into that company. So that's my four rules. And I think that if you use them on a regular basis, you'll find that it works pretty well.
That's incredible. I love how you keep it simple. And thank you for sharing your four rules. Those rules are certainly going to help cut down the list of companies for you to focus on. So are there any reasons where you may sell your shares? For example, if a company reduces or eliminates their dividend, what would cause you to sell your shares?
Well, in my third book, I added a fifth rule. And that was really to try to help you identify when a company might be running into trouble. Because there are times when, you know, I mean, obviously, a company can't pay a dividend unless it's earning money. Its earnings have to be there. And the earnings have to continue to grow year after year, or at least on at a reasonable rate. And but if a company does begin to run into trouble, sometimes there's warning signs that you can pick up. It might be the payout ratio, but I don't necessarily jump on payout ratios right off the bat. I look at it and then I decide, well, is it reasonable or is there something that's causing it? Is the company doing something about it? Are they, you know, trying to reduce debt or are they selling assets to try to, you know, correct the problem? So, I don't necessarily, I got to step back. I told you that I have my list of stocks to consider. So I own 12 stocks. If one of those 12 stocks cut the dividend, I would, first of all, I wouldn't just jump off and sell. I would really look at the company and decide, well, is this a necessary cut? Is there a reason for it? Are they looking for it to buy another company or do some expansion and they need the money? Or are they in fact in a debt situation where they want to try to reduce that debt? And if I can find a reasonable explanation, then I won't sell. And, but if, you know, if you get hit out of the blue and the dividend gets cut without any notice or any warning, then I probably would consider selling.
And I think your four rules are going to help you to minimize getting into that situation where companies are cutting their dividends.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole idea. You only stick with solid companies, people or companies that have a long history of paying a dividend, of growing their dividend, of going through various market cycles. I mean, they've been through it several times, so they should be prepared and understand, like people talking about a recession today. Well, the large companies that have been through recessions time and time again.
Henry, do you own any U.S. stocks at all, or is it just Canadian stocks?
We did own some U.S. stocks in our RSPs, and but we sold them. When the when the dollar dropped extremely low in comparison to the U.S. dollar, and the price of those U.S. stocks went really sky high, we sold, and I reinvested the money back into the existing Canadian stocks that I own. And I haven't bought any U.S. stocks since.
People talk about diversification quite a bit, especially index and ETF investors are always looking for large diversification. Do you feel that you are diversified enough with only 12 stocks in your portfolio?
Not really. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want all my money in one stock, or I wouldn't want it in just one sector. Well, in a few sectors. So I have my stocks in four sectors with 12 stocks. So not necessarily evenly, but I'm not a fan of diversification. I'm a fan of owning quality companies. And if it, you know, if it means that I'm only going to buy a few sectors or a few companies, then I'm fine with that because I feel comfortable knowing or believing that those companies will continue to pay me my income regardless of the market condition. And I don't feel a need for diversification other than I want to spread my money across quality companies. And I'll add another comment here is that I'm not overly concerned about how much money I have invested in one company. You know, I sort of said I don't want all my money in just one company. But if one company happens to consistently provide reasonable yield and it consistently raises its dividend and it's offering a higher yield than the other companies in the same sector, not a big difference, you know, maybe a 0.5% or something, then I'll continue to put my money into that particular stock. Because later on, like the market changes, and sometimes one stock will do better than another, one sector will do better than another. So even quality stocks will go up and down. One stock will be undervalued today, but maybe a year from now, it'll be over, you know, overpriced. So you can pick and choose which stocks to buy, but if you happen to only be able to buy a few stocks today, well, go for it.
Are you reinvesting your dividends?
Yes, I'm a strong believer in reinvesting dividends. Most people, I don't know, I don't know, I shouldn't have said most. A lot of people say, well, just leave the money in your account, add it to your additional new funds, and buy what you want to buy. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I prefer to constantly increase my share ownership. In other words, every time I receive a dividend, it's reinvested the same day. I own a couple more shares. I don't need to do anything. Now, again, those most dividends are not thousands of dollars. You know, they might be $50, $100. They might even be $1,000. But to get that money invested immediately, to get it earning you more income immediately, is my preference. And if you have new money to invest, good. Put it where you want to and buy the stock that is offering you a better yield or put it in the sector that you like to buy. But get those dividends working for you and compounding.
Are you talking about DRIPs, dividend reinvestment plans?
Whether it's DRIP or whether, you know, it could be the broker dividend reinvestment. Yes. Yeah, because, you know, they're synthetic DRIPs where they only buy full shares. Right? Yeah.
The other comment I hear a lot from people when it comes to investing is that it takes too much time. They say that they don't have hours and hours each day to try and research which stocks to buy. So, Henry, how much time do you spend on researching stocks?
Absolutely none, because as I said, you do all your analysis up front. I've got my list of stocks. You know, I have a list of I have a small investment account, and on my blog site, I publish the monthly update on it. So every month I buy a few shares or reinvest the dividends, but I have a watch list of about 16 stocks, and that's it. I don't care about any other stock. I don't do any analysis on those stocks. That's my list. So when I have money to invest, I just enter the price. It comes up with a yield difference, and I buy the one that I feel is offering me the best deal. Now, it might not be the highest yield, but it might be, you know, a higher yield than I can get from some of the others. So I don't do any research on an ongoing basis. And I didn't do it when I was had money to invest. I'm retired now, so obviously I'm not investing anymore. But there is no reason to do continuous analysis. You've got your stock list. You've got your 15, 20 stocks that you've decided that are the ones you like. So there's no more research to do. And, you know, the other point is, you know, there's that perception that you got to buy low and sell high. But even dividend investors say, well, you got to buy low. Well, that's not right. I don't think it's right. I think all you have to do is buy when you can get a reasonable return on your money, a reasonable yield. And, you know, I notice you have a podcast on that where you look at the yield difference, right? If it's below or above the 10-year average, then that's the time you want to try to buy. And there's always one or two stocks that are providing you a reasonable yield difference. It doesn't have to be a large difference. In fact, you don't want a large difference. You want something that is reasonable within their 10-year average or their ongoing average yield.
As you know, dividends are not guaranteed. Companies are under no legal obligation to pay you a dividend. So companies can reduce the dividend or eliminate the dividend anytime they want. Therefore, how do you have any confidence in investing in dividend stocks?
You know, it's a confidence you gain over the years. The longer you own a dividend-paying stock and the continuous performance of that stock, well, you get to the point where you just accept that this is a quality company, and you don't have to worry about a dividend cut. Or they might reduce the dividend, they might not raise the dividend because of whatever reason. A lot of good companies will do that. They won't raise the dividend. They'll hold off increasing the dividend.
We saw that with the five Canadian banks during 2008-2009 when they didn't raise their dividends.
Well, even today, you know, some of the banks have not raised their dividend. They've sort of held it, right? But that doesn't mean I'm going to think about selling them or don't have any faith in them. I think they're doing it for a good reason. You know, they're preparing themselves for a recession or a housing problem, mortgage problem, whatever. But again, you do enough of your upfront evaluation. You try to identify the best companies you can. And sure, there's always that possibility, but you've minimized it, as you said, to the point where it's really not a concern.
Are you concerned at all about the current environment we're in right now with high inflation, the federal banks raising rates in the U.S. and in Canada, talk about the economy going into a recession? Are you worried at all about any of those things?
No, because I'm not one of those individuals that has 187% of their disposable income tied to debt. I don't have any debt. So, but no, in fact, I'll add another just little story. At the end of last year, and we're talking 2021, not 2022, I've started to sell large portions of our RIF account because we've decided we don't need the income from our RIFs at all. So if we leave it, then when we die, of course, the income tax is going to be 50% or more on the estate tax. Well, so we've started to take down much larger withdrawals than our minimum requirement. And when I did that in January of 2022, I lost $15,000 of income because we paid the taxes and we distributed most of those funds to our kids and grandkids. So $15,000 is a pretty hefty cut in your income. Well, move ahead to December 2022. I've recovered 13,000 of that. And you know, 2022 is a period when we had high inflation, we had rising costs, we had the concerns about a possible recession. Well, no, I'm not concerned about all those things.
That's great to hear, especially from someone like yourself that has decades and decades of experience as an income investor. Henry, it has been an honor and a privilege to have you on this podcast. And thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom with our audience. This is going to help so many of our listeners, especially those just starting out, and even those in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who have never invested in individual stocks. Henry, where can people find out about your four books that we talked about today?
Well, the books are listed on Amazon, you know, so they just have to look up either my name or the book name, the book title, and they should find them there. Yeah.
Henry, I know you're on Twitter, and I'll put your Twitter handle in our show notes. Can you tell our audience where to find your website?
I'm going to have to look it up because I'm not even sure what it's. It's called risingyieldoninvestments.blogspot.com.
I'll put that in our show notes as well. Thanks again, Henry, for being on our podcast today. I really appreciate it.
That's great. Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.